Hi, this is Morgan Michael welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness. I believe that we all have an innate need to be seen, heard, and understood. When we dedicate ourselves to kindness, the ripple effects in our schools can be life-changing. Through this podcast, I want to challenge you to question your assumptions, amplify your insight, and embrace a willingness to go beyond the status quo in education. Together, let's learn how to make a big impact, one small act at a time. Have you ever found yourself puzzling over fostering resilience in our students, but felt at a loss for how to get there? Well, you're in for a treat. My remarkable guest describes through animated and relatable storytelling how to do just that by developing grit, growth mindset, and confidence within our students. Dr. Jillian Roberts is a renowned child psychologist, author, professor, and parent. She earned her PhD at the age of 26, became an associate professor at the University of Victoria at 32, and shortly after became the associate dean of the Faculty of Education. During this time, Dr. Roberts built one of Victoria, BC's most successful child psychology practices. Considered a go-to child psychology expert for journalists, Dr. Roberts' work has appeared in the New York Times and the Toronto Sun. She is also a regular contributor to the Huffington Post Canada, the CBC, and Global News. Her best-selling series of children's books was released in 2016 to international acclaim. In early 2017, Dr. Roberts co-founded Family Sparks to offer families a supportive, resource-rich community to help them navigate our increasingly complicated world. For more information, visit my website, smallactbigimpact.com, and search under episode number 13, or search familysparks.com for more information. I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. Sometimes our experiences in school can really frame the way we see ourselves as adults. Teachers and parents have a lot of power in being able to frame experiences and quote-unquote failures in such a way that they can encourage more of a growth mindset as opposed to shutting a child down and making them feel feelings of shame. Can you speak to that and why it's so important?
Absolutely. I think it has to do with the concept of understanding that we're all on a journey of growth and that there's going to be mistakes made along the way. And how are we able to help a young person through a mistake in a way that isn't shaming and allows them to learn and continue growing? Like your question brought to my mind an experience I had as a new teacher. So before I was a psychologist, I was a teacher. And I was a French teacher, and I had little ones would come to this French room, and we would do lessons, and then they would leave, and I would have all sorts of stickers and fun little things on my desk, and I was lining up the children to go back to their class, and I glanced at my desk, and I noticed that my big stack of stickers was gone, and I looked at the floor. No, it wasn't on the floor. And these were grade two students. And I looked at all the students, and one little girl had on a dress, and she had like this big tummy under the dress. Like she obviously snatched the stickers and put them under her dress. And the teacher came to the class, and I asked everyone but the little girl to go. And then as soon as the little girl was there and looking up at me and knew that she'd been caught out, she just started to cry. Like Aww. Just tears and tears came down her eyes. She, you know, had impulsively done something and now was being found out. And I was a very young teacher. I was like 22 years old, something like that. And I remember in that moment, I had to make a choice how I responded to her in her mistake, in her error. And all I could think of doing was picking her up and putting her on my lap and holding her while she cried. Mm. And it was a rocking chair, actually, that the chair was, and I rocked her back and forth. And I don't know if today we can pick up kids, you know, like I think there's probably, you know, rules around not touching children like that. But back then it was okay, you know, to hug or pick up a child. And, you know, I didn't have to say anything at all. Like I didn't have to say anything, nothing at all. She said, sorry. And I told her, I forgave her. She pulled the stickers back out and nothing more was said. Nothing more was needed to be said. And then, years and years and years and years later, like I'm talking 17 years later, I am a professor at the University of Victoria, and we used to do interviews for entrance into our Bachelor of Education program. Mm-hmm. And I found myself in an interview with this grown-up little girl.
Oh my goodness, really?
She had decided, and what was interesting is that I taught in Ontario, and I was a professor in Victoria, and so her life brought her to Victoria too.
Wow.
And and we recognized each other, we hugged, you know, and I don't think she ended up picking our program. I think she had another offer and went somewhere else, but it was just so interesting for me to see her coming full circle and wanting to become a teacher herself. Wow. We didn't talk in that moment of her interview about that mistake, like nothing was said, like we just recognized each other and wished her goodwill, you know, nothing was said. But I think what I'm trying to say is that I remember that moment in my mind as a teacher where I could have sent her to the principal's office. Mm-hmm. You know, I could have called her parents. I could have given her detention or something like that. You know, those were all choices to me. But what I chose to do was just to hold her. Mm. Because she knew already, you know, she had made a mistake.
Yes.
And she didn't need any more. She didn't need anything more. To get back on that correct course. She was already understanding she was on the wrong course. So I think what I'm trying to say is it brings us to this idea of what is our role. You know, are we, you know, the judgers, and our role is to bestow judgment, or are we pedagogues where mm-hmm. we're guiding that child into the right place, you know, and mistakes are just opportunities to learn and to grow and not to be shamed, you know?
Yes. I love that story. It made me actually teary eyed because I think, I think it's
it reflects, I think, how I view things. Yeah. It was funny because I just last night on my Facebook page and on Twitter, one of our writing team sent me this beautiful, beautiful, New York Times article about inmates who mm. then take care of dying inmates.
Oh.
So they've got like life sentences and some die, right?
Yes.
And some inmates offer to be nurses in hospital and to care for the other dying inmates.
Wow.
And how they felt like they had a new life within the prison because they got to be a caretaker, right?
Wow. Where
their role within that prison was to be there beside dying inmates and help their last hours and days be comfortable. And how beautiful was that they had no freedom themselves, but they were still acting out of a place of kindness and compassion. So that kind of theme of forgiveness and reconciliation and love is very much close to my heart and how I try to practice.
I think that's so important. And I think when it comes to what kids need from us as parents or as educators, what do you think they're most seeking, and what do you think they need in order to thrive?
They need to belong, mm-hmm. unconditionally belong, and to be validated for who they are authentically. So I think one of the things that I struggle with is that parents sometimes have a view of what they want their child to be. You know, a father might want their child to be an athletic star. The mother might want the child to be a beauty queen. And, sometimes children aren't, that's not who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think children need to be accepted and loved unconditionally for who they are authentically, and feel a sense of validation and belonging for who they are, and for there to be space for the adults in their life to bracket any of their own expectations, and just delight in the being of their child.
Oh, that's beautiful. Bracketing their own expectations. I think that's a really interesting way of putting it, because I think you're right. I think when we first have children, sometimes, or when we envision having children even, we often, or I've even been guilty of doing this, you sort of look down at this little baby and you think, this is going to be a mini version of me, or whatever sort of expectations you may have around what parenting looks like, what childhood looks like, what that experience will be like. And I think the difference between the experience as it exists in real time versus that expectation can be very problematic. And I love that idea of bracketing your own sort of expectations or sort of ideals, because when we can do that, when we can sort of challenge that expectation of what things should look like, that really then we can just accept and go with the flow and really see that child for who they are. And I think that's really what kids are looking for, right? And so you were the dean of education at our local University of Victoria.
What do you associate dean, but yes.
Oh, sure.
Team. Yeah.
So you were in a leadership role with mm-hmm. developing teachers, and what do you think the fundamental message of is that teachers need to hear in order to serve their students and their schools most effectively?
Well, right now, if I was to answer that really honestly, it is that the world is changing, and what teachers need to know and be able to do this next century has to be different than what was done this past century. Mm. That the landscape has changed, and we just can't keep on doing what we used to do. So I think if I were to condense it in two words, it would be adapt. Mm. Adapt to the new reality of our world and be innovative in how you think about teaching within that new context. That's really what I see as important. From a psychological perspective, though, like to get deeper than just like, you know, the content of what's being taught, I think it's important to understand that we need to understand how to nurture the whole child, not just their mind or their physical body, but also their social skills and their belief in themselves, their resilience, their self-efficacy, their ability to be hopeful within a world where there's news streaming of disaster and tragedy all around. Children need to have like that grit, you know, and yes, that resilience. So it's understanding that your role is different than it might have been 50 years ago. And to be a good teacher in this new era, it requires bringing, I think, your whole person to your role, mm-hmm. and being able to delight in the challenge of that.
Yes. And I would agree. I think a lot of the conversations that I've been having with guests for this podcast have really centered around that idea that this industrialized model of education, where we're processing children and they either pass or fail, and there's sort of this decided upon content that we're all going to explore, that's just really not reflective of the real world and the future. And so, like you said, I think there's pieces around sort of creating the opportunity for innovation and creativity and mm-hmm. sort of problem solving on a really fundamental level about big problems or big interesting issues that might be coming up that kids can actually have really, really creative solutions to if mm-hmm. we give them the time and space and sort of our trust in them and our belief in them. And then, like you said, the flip side, the developing the social and emotional learning skills that they need to have grit, to have that growth mindset that in spite of adversity or challenges or a changing landscape, that they can adapt. And so mm-hmm. I guess this is really a two-part question. But first of all, I'd love to dig into, if we were to create innovative and creative learning environments, we have to understand that we first need to create environments that really promote a sense of belonging and safety, because nobody is going to be creative or innovative if they don't feel safe to take risks, to share their ideas, to think outside of the box. So how would you say we develop such an environment so that kids are able to have agency over their learning, to really go outside of the box and be creative in a way that makes them feel safe? Can you share any ideas or perspectives on that?
Yeah, well, I'm brought back to thinking of my own role as teacher. So, you know, I still, of course, teach at UVic, and I teach a combination of undergraduate and graduate classes. And sometimes in graduate seminar, where we'll have people from lots of different backgrounds, like we'll have people that have an undergraduate degree, perhaps in psychology or an undergraduate degree in education. But sometimes I have people from philosophy or social work or nursing, all sorts of different people that might want to do a master's in psychology. And sometimes when we're having seminar, someone will misarticulate a term, for example. So maybe a part of the brain or a psychological term. And it's easy to do, because if you've come from a different place, like a different background, or maybe you've come from a different country, all you've ever done is read these terms. So you might not ever have said them out loud. You maybe never heard someone else say it out loud. Right. So you're, you know, like pituary instead of pituitary or something like that. And I'm very quick in the moment to validate and not let anybody snicker or, you know, I'm very, very quick in that moment to say something along the lines of, you know, I said that word that way for many years myself, or, you know, something like that. I remember there was this story of a French singer, and like 100 years ago, Piaf, and she was busking on the side of the road, and a fancy French woman heard her sing and was amazed and asked her, "Would you like to come to my home and perform? I'm having a dinner party tonight, and I'll pay you very well." So Piaf came to that home, of this fancy, fancy French home, and had a performance which was just spectacular. And the woman was so, so grateful that she said to Piaf, "Why don't you come and have dinner with us? And we'll set a place for you beside me at the table, and you can tell us about how you got to be where you are and what we could do to help you in your career."
Wow.
So Piaf, you know, sat at this table. You know, of course, she never sat at a table like that, didn't know how to use utensils, didn't know anything. And so they had their first course, which I think was like a seafood course. And then afterwards, the server, the servers brought little dishes, little bowls of hot water with lemon in them, which of course are to rinse your fingers, right, between courses. And because Piaf was sitting in the place of honor, she was given it first. And she had no idea what this little bowl of lemon water was for.
Right.
So she picked it up and drank it, thinking that it was a tea, right?
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And the whole table started to snicker at her. And so what the hostess did, the woman, is she picked up her bowl and drank it too, just to make a statement that this is not okay, and she's my guest, and we're not going to laugh at her. If you're going to laugh at her, you're going to laugh at me, right? That kind of a story. Yes. And what that reminds me of is the responsibility of the leader in the room.
Yes.
You know, if that leader is the teacher, is the dean, is, you know, whoever's leading in that room, it's their responsibility to set the tone of respect, and that it's okay to take risks. It's okay to say a word wrong. It's okay to make a mistake. It's okay. It's not the end of the world. Who really cares? Really?
Yes.
You know? But we're going to give each other that respect and that space to grow in the ways that we need to. And there's not going to be any kind of ego, me, bigger than you, smaller kind of thing. We're just going to put all of that stuff at the wayside and just be authentically people trying to learn something together.
I love that. And I think it really does speak to the nature of leadership and the fact that you're steering a ship and you're setting the tone, and that it's a tremendous responsibility. But if you can be cognizant of that and really aware of your role, that, like you said, you sort of lead the way and you nip that stuff right in the bud before it even has the space to evolve within a classroom into a culture. So I think that's such a wonderful, I love both of those stories in terms of illustrating how one can do that in a very small way. It doesn't have to be a big program. It can be just really the way that you interact and validate children as they're asking questions or they're contributing or they're interacting with one another. I would like to talk a little bit about this idea of growth mindset and resiliency and how you encourage children who may feel down on themselves in the face of adversity or may have kind of some negative self-talk around who they are as people when they feel as though they're not doing well at a task, if that makes sense. So for example, I've had, you know, children who once in a while will shut down with math or, you know, even with art. There's sort of this perfectionist ideal that they have in their head that doesn't necessarily reflect at all sort of my expectations, but it's sort of the self-imposed or their experiential sort of imposed upon ideal for perfection. And how does one as a teacher really help that child to reframe that negative self-talk and to separate them from the work that they're doing or the efforts that they make in school? Does that make sense, that question?
Yeah. And I think the way to do that is to celebrate mistakes. You know, like when you think about some of the amazing scientific breakthroughs that we've had, they've been stumbled upon. They've been through mistakes, right? That people have really learned. When someone has or makes a mistake, rather than frowning or a great big red X or whatever, find what you can find in that mistake to say, oh, wow, and this doesn't quite answer this, but this shows that, or, you know, to find a way to allow the child to not be so afraid of that mistake, because when that mistake was made in the past, it wasn't shamed or it wasn't punitive. I feel like I'm just telling you tons of stories.
No,
today,
it's fabulous.
I have another story.
Great.
This was when I was doing my doctoral training, at the University of Calgary. We had a play therapist, a very famous, well-respected play therapist, come up to teach a course. And I was so lucky to take the class. And it was like, I didn't need to take the class. I'd already done all my coursework, but I really badly wanted to learn from this woman. And one of the things that she had in her class that was so fascinating were the videos and videos and videos of her in therapy, play therapy with children. She had edited moments of because when you're doing play therapy, a lot of it is a lot of play, and then you've got your few therapeutic moments, but within a sea of just kind of play.
Yeah.
So to be able to condense down what those really important moments were was interesting for me, and I think my classmates at the time. So there was one moment where she was with a little girl in a hospital. So she worked in out of a psychiatric inpatient with little children at a big American hospital.
Wow.
So she was in this hospital clinic on the floor building blocks with a little girl, maybe 4 years old. And the girl made a whole bunch of little blocks up into a big tower and accidentally turned to pick up another block, and her elbow made the whole tower fall down.
Aww.
And yeah, and so the professor paused the video and asked the class, "What would you say? How would you respond?" Right. And so she pointed at me and said, "What would you say?" And I said, "I don't know. Maybe I'd say something like, 'Uh oh, you know, it fell down or something.'" And she says, "Absolutely not.
Oh,
that's absolutely not what we would say." what we would say is sometimes things fall down.
Okay.
Right? Sometimes
yes.
things fall down. Right? So and then she actually made the whole class say in unison, sometimes things fall down. And it was powerful for me because I realized what she was trying to get at in teaching me that.
Yes.
Was that sometimes mistakes are made and we have an opportunity to either respond in a way that's neutral or negative.
Right.
And respond in a way that allows that child to be accepting of mistakes. And it's funny because all from that moment on, all through 20 years later now, I say that a variation of sometimes things fall down every time.
Mm.
So child is in my office and they fill up a drink and they come into my office and they spill water or juice everywhere. My first initial reaction is to be annoyed.
Sure.
Right? But I bracket that away and I say, sometimes juice spills.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
If I have a parent who's like tremendously, tremendously embarrassed because they've missed an appointment or they forgot an appointment or something. And, they're trying to make things right with me. I say, sometimes life gets in the way.
Yeah.
Sometimes we forget.
Yes.
Sometimes checks bounce.
Yes.
Sometimes, you know, sometimes cars have flat tires. Some, you know, and I have noticed when I can respond in a way that is accepting.
Yes.
Just like the whole stress melts away on the other person's face. Like every, like it all just, it's like, you know, and when she replayed, like continued playing that video and she had said, you know, sometimes blocks fall down,
mm-hmm.
the little girl went, oh, okay. And just started building another set of blocks.
Right.
Right. But in a different kind of a setting for a little traumatized child, they could have burst into tears.
Right. Absolutely.
So I think in terms of that idea of building grit or building resilience, there's something to be said about helping to reframe mistakes in a
yes. growth
mindset way that encourages the exploration of that mistake and the acceptance of that mistake and the honoring that mistakes happen and that our job is to learn from them and keep going.
Yes. And I think ultimately I can imagine, and I'm just, you know, I'm just guessing, but whenever I've felt the need to make it right with somebody and I've had a validating statement come from them on the other side, it relaxes you because I think sometimes it's ingrained in us that when we make mistakes, that those mistakes have the power to cast us out or make it so that we don't belong anymore. Or, you know, it can be really difficult to feel connected because of that. And so I think when we're aware of that power that sometimes these really small trigger points can have for children, and if we're able to reframe that for them, that it alleviates so much of that stress. And back to that whole shame issue, it's like it takes the shame right out of it. And I think that's a very, very powerful lesson. So thank you for sharing that story. The stories are great because people love learning through stories. And I think these types of phrases and approaches stick really well with stories because we attach ourselves to narrative, right?
Right. And I think what it also encapsulates is a concept of grace.
Mm. You know,
like we, as leaders, as teachers, psychologists, helpers, you know, we can be gracious.
Mm-hmm.
We can honor being gracious, you know, and a validating phrase to another person is modeling graciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think that we need a big shot of graciousness in our interpersonal actions. Yeah,
we do. And I'd like to sort of go a little bit further and I'd like to touch a little bit on depression and anxiety in children. We know that depression and anxiety and even suicide rates in Canada have been, increasing. And I guess this is a really important topic because a lot of us as educators and even as parents are aware of that rise. And some of us, may not understand how it manifests for children. And then also, how do we respond to a child who may be exhibiting, you know, symptoms of depression or symptoms of anxiety? And how do we make space for them, acknowledging their experiences and really being mindful of their trigger points, like respecting that maybe it may not seem like a trigger point to us, but that there are small instances that may trigger a student to really have a heightened sense of anxiety, for example. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. I'm gonna speak first to depression because mm-hmm. I think it thematically connects to what we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So a key element or a core element of depression is self-loathing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this idea that that instead of having that pain be sort of directed outside of yourself to other people through anger, that pain is directed internally inside of yourself. And there's a large element of self-punishment, self-loathing, self-hatred, hopelessness, believing that you are bad to the core and that you there's no place for you in the world, that other people would be better off if you were not in the world. You're that bad, right? And I think that the ability to be gracious with yourself and to be forgiving of yourself, if you've made a mistake, even a big mistake, that you can still love yourself, I think is something that is difficult for many people and is something that needs to be taught. And I think that when children encounter graciousness in other people, then, you know, it's easier for them to be gracious with themselves. Another example.
Great.
I had a young woman who went through a period of promiscuity, and there were some repercussions to that that were deeply embarrassing to her and her family.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was in a place of deep, deep depression and came to see me. And so my perspective with her was, you know what? It's normal to feel sexual. It's normal to have those urges and those feelings. And it's normal to like feeling special or wanted in somebody else's eyes. You know, we were designed to be sexual. Like, the fact that you've discovered your sexuality and explored it, there's nothing in that on its own level that is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing wrong about those feelings and urges that you had. You know, we did move on and talk about how to keep yourself safe, right?
Sure.
Right, and boundaries, but that at the essence, that desire to be sexually connected with another person, there was nothing wrong with that.
Yes.
Where she had felt deeply shamed in the interactions that she had with other important adults in her life. She felt like she was, you know, a slut or some of those horrible words.
Mm-hmm.
She felt like because she had acted upon those urges that it somehow cast her into you know, a very bad girl place.
Yes.
Where my work with her was really around how wonderful that you felt those feelings, how wonderful that you felt alive in that way, and how can you go forward in your life enjoying that part of yourself but being safe and making sure that your partners are respectful and safe towards you.
Right.
So just flipping it right around.
Yes.
But that's that sense of self-acceptance and love and being able to forgive yourself, I think is hugely needed in terms of allowing people who experience depression to recover.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, anxiety is the fear of all of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's of making the mistake. It's the fear of failure. It's the belief something really bad is going to happen. And you're just living in a state of perpetual fear that, and so what do? You shrink, you know, you either don't go out or you don't try or you don't risk you isolate yourself. You don't do that performance. You don't try that to be out with that new group of friends. You just your world becomes smaller and smaller and smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So because somehow inside of yourself you believe that you aren't capable of managing the challenges that are inherent in those new situations.
Mm.
So and or the fear of failure is so heavy and daunting in your mind that that you you know you just shut down.
Mm-hmm.
I have almost 18-year-old daughter, and she just did her driving test and she failed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like she was upset, and you know when is she going to do the next test, or does she even want to do her next test, kind of thing.
Yes.
It's like, well, great, now
yes.
you know exactly what they're going to ask you on that exam. You've
yes.
done the exam, you know exactly where you're going to go, you know exactly where you're going to drive, you know exactly what they're going to take points off for, and like, you're all set now.
Yes, you've created a whole lot of certainty for yourself.
Yeah, this was a practice run.
Yes.
You know, now the next one is the real one, right?
Yes.
Way to go, you had a good dry run, you know?
Oh, that's so supportive. And being able to reframe that for her in mm-hmm. such a way that it doesn't feel shaming, or it doesn't feel like a failure in that that point of no return, I think sometimes that kids can get into, and even adults. I mean, mm-hmm. a lot of adults have a difficult time with anxiety, and sort of that fear piece holding them back from living the life that they really do want to live. And so in terms of, say, for example, I had a student in my school or in my classroom who had a really hard time with anxiety. And so she would be seeking a lot of reinforcement from me. And of course, I was willing to support that desire to make her feel safe and to give her that support. But I was also aware of that real need to also help her to develop her independence. So how do you walk that line between being supportive and then helping them to sort of be able to take measurable, appropriate risks in a safe environment?
I mean, the answer to that just is right on the tip of my tongue. And it's, therapists learn really quickly in training that the goal is to lean into anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to think about what that means carefully. So leaning into anxiety, so it's like pushing back into anxiety, means that you're not letting the anxiety win. You're not letting that anxiety dictate what happens in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not pushing back so fast and aggressively that it's going to be counterproductive.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So so it's like baby steps into anxiety. So let's give some examples. Like if you had a child in your class that didn't want to do a group presentation,
mm-hmm.
or didn't want to present their findings in front of the class because they were so anxious, I don't know that I would make them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know that I would make them present, but I certainly wouldn't let them get off of not presenting at all.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So I would be thinking about, I'm not going to let anxiety win in this situation, but I'm not going to push them so far past what they're able to do or what they can manage that they would shut down.
Yes.
And right? So there's
yes.
that. Again, that you're taught, and that's what you were getting at, I think, in your question to me is, where's that balance?
That's right.
Yeah, the balance is leaning into it,
mm-hmm.
like, and so in every situation, what that looks like is going to be a little bit differently. So what I might do in a situation where a child can't present in front of the class is I would get them to present to me at recess,
mm-hmm.
or I'd get them to present to their parents and me after school or something.
Mm-hmm.
I have a very, very good friend who's a music teacher on Prince Edward Island, where we live on Vancouver Island and Prince Edward Island. And she has the Confederation Center in Charlottetown, which is a big, beautiful conference hall.
Mm-hmm.
She'll do her recitals.
Mm-hmm.
And she will have children, piano students, that just can't. You know, they can't go to recital. They can't
mm-hmm.
play on that stage with everybody else there.
Mm-hmm.
So she doesn't make them.
Yes.
But what she does is she will take them down when the Confederation Center is closed. She'll get the janitor to let her in, turn on the lights, all the big lights shining at the stage. She'll open up the grand piano and she'll be sitting maybe with the parents in the audience. And she makes that child go onto that stage and play that piece.
Mm. Wow.
So the child is sitting in front of that grand piano with the light shining on them, but there's no audience.
Yes.
But she hasn't let the child get away or get out of not doing it at all.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So there's this idea of leaning into the anxiety, which is, you know, it's knowing where that line is and knowing where that balance is it takes wisdom and it takes experience. And sometimes I'll have my own students come to me, my own student psychologists come to me, and, you know, they're well educated and, you know, they've had lots of clinical time now, but they've made a mistake. Like they missed the line themselves.
Yes.
They either pushed too hard or not enough or something, and they missed it.
Yes.
And they're feeling
right,
full of remorse because they clinically got it wrong.
Right.
And then I try to model right for them what they're trying to model to their own patients, which is sometimes we get it wrong.
I love it.
Oh, sometimes, you know, sometimes milk spills. Sometimes we get it wrong. What did you learn about that line and that balance that you're going to bring forward in your clinical experience? How are you going to do that? And how are you going to, now that you realize you've made it wrong with this child, how are you going to make it right with that child? What is your plan to doing that? And how are you going to forgive yourself?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I have this this little concept that I use with my students and with my employees and with my patients and my children, my husband, like all, like, and it's like a reset button. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had conflict. We've made a mistake. I've made a mistake. Mm-hmm. Can we all apologize, be forgiven, and set a reset button, mm-hmm. just like you're rebooting a computer?
Yes.
And when it comes up again, we brush ourselves off, we get back up, and we go forward.
Yes.
Our day's not ruined. Our dinner's not ruined. Our holiday is not ruined.
Yes.
You know, like we've learned how to go with the flow and let go.
I love that. That's so funny that you say that, because I just recently wrote, I like to write blog posts and do writing and sort of reflect on motherhood and education and different strategies. But I just recently wrote a blog post about the redo, I think I called it. And just this idea that I didn't show up the way that I wanted to as a mother one morning. And I just felt like, you know, when you're really, you're busy and you're feeling like you're juggling all these pieces and you feel the energy in the room is not positive. And, mm-hmm. and we just stopped and we did a redo and we jumped mm-hmm. back into bed and we pretended to wake mm-hmm. up again in the morning and start again. And it was a really fun exercise and it felt light and it really just changed the tone. It was like what you say, it's kind of this opportunity to try again and to show up the way that we want to. And when we realize that we actually have the power to shift that whole narrative by being conscious about it and by really digging into that and committing to trying again, that's so powerful.
And you know what a lesson you taught your child, which, you know, like what a lesson, what a way of showing them mm-hmm. that should they have a bad day, a bad test, a bad fight with a friend, whatever, mm-hmm. that this is something that they can do to redo it, to make it better again. I think there's beauty in modeling that to your children.
Mm, thank you. I want to talk a little bit about social media. I know that you have done courses for approaching technology. I mean, we cannot deny how ubiquitous you know technology is within our lives. People generally have their phones on them 24/7. How, you know, I mean, it kind of gives the illusion of creating a sense of connection, but actually has contributed or has been shown to contribute kind of a rise in loneliness and even again back to that depression and anxiety and isolation. So how do we help integrate technology within our homes and even in the classroom while we're sort of avoiding those pitfalls associated with exposing ourselves to tech, like in terms of that, you know, that reward seeking circuitry, the stuff that people, I mean, companies are really trying to get us hooked on their games because there's a monetizing sort of mm-hmm. engine behind it. So can you speak to that a little bit, technology and appropriate ways to use it?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you mention it, because my first adult parenting book is coming out in the fall. It's mm-hmm. right now available on Amazon, and it's called Kids, Sex, and Screens. Mm-hmm. And what it's focusing a great deal on sexting and the sexual risks of social media, but it does encompass everything that you've just talked about. In the book, I present a 7-point parental compass where things like nurturing real life relationships and putting boundaries on devices and managing that balancing line between letting your child be connected with their friends, but not online, but not so much that they neglect their real life opportunities.
Yes.
So, so that comes out in the fall of 2018. I think that one thing that's important is when a child receives their first device, whatever age they are, the moment that they begin to explore social media, that there is a social media plan that's developed in the family. And in Kids, Sex, and Screens, I offer a template plan, but different plans could be, created in different homes to reflect different cultures. But the plan that I offer has less than 10 key points that children need to remember when they're using social media. So one is to only post something with somebody else's permission, you know, never to like or share something that was embarrassing to someone else. You know, just like in real life, if we hear one friend insulting another friend, we don't pass that insult along, right? If you do pass that insult along, you're a part of that insult, and it's not cool. You might not feel like in that moment you can say, hey, that doesn't sound nice to me. Maybe you can. Maybe you're strong enough and you have courage to do that. But even just like not letting it get any more airtime, not passing it along, passing along an insult, only pass along a compliment. We only like or share things that are positive. We don't put anything online for noise, right? If we're posting something, there's a reason for why we're posting it. And we try to post things that are positive. Only posting things we'd want our grandma to see, right?
Yes.
I think what I would say around social media and parents and teachers and classrooms is, what is the plan? What is the social media plan before we let children go there? Do we just give them a device on their 12th birthday and say, have fun?
Yes.
Or do we sit down with them and talk about what their responsibilities are once they're an online citizen and what those responsibilities look like? And things like not following pop-ups. I've had kids get into a world of grief because they're doing a science project and something pops up on their screen when they're Googling something, and then they follow it, and then they're in like dark zone.
Yes.
So things like that. I think it's critical to have a social media plan. For some families, I've had just some really creative ways for some families about how they manage the amount of time, right? So like I've had some families get into huge conflict with their children when they try to be authoritative about that. Like, you're only allowed 1 hour a day, no matter what.
Yes.
And if the child is in the middle of a great game with a friend and now it's being shut down, it can be really hard. Whereas I've had other families say, well, you can have theoretically as much online time as you want, but you have to earn it. So these are ways that you earn your online time. And I had one family just recently, it was a really, really creative, situation. And it was a little boy who had expressed interest in playing the guitar. And he was taking lessons and doing some Guitar Hero and some like online YouTube lessons. And he just kind of petered out, like how to peter out with, you know, instruments or whatever. And his father was disappointed that he petered out because they bought this guitar and, you know, I think that the dad himself played and, you know, it was disappointing.
Right.
So what the dad said is, you know what, you want to play video games? Fine. But minute for minute, it is connected to how much you practiced your guitar.
Wow.
If you want to play 2 hour like binge with a friend tonight, you have to somehow through this day practice your guitar for that same amount of time.
Right.
And did that not work like magic? Wow. For this particular family. And now this little boy is playing in a little band and he's sending me songs that he's done in GarageBand. And and he's very good now, like very good on the guitar. He has his dad there to help him and stuff too. But what it did, so what can happen sometimes when learning new things is you need like a critical amount of instruction before you feel good with it. And if you don't get that critical amount of instruction, it just feels like the learning curve is hard, but then once to a place of fluency, then it's more enjoyable. And so what the dad really did is gave him the motivation to get up that learning curve. And so I've been just like fascinated with that as a concept. And I've been playing with that idea with other families where maybe it's like a reading course online or Duolingo where you're studying French, or it's Prodigy Math where you're practicing math, or it's whatever it is.
Yes.
But that you're, and sometimes it doesn't work for a child who's really involved in lots of extracurricular things. Like they physically don't have the time for it to be one-to-one.
Yes.
So maybe it's like half an hour earns you an hour.
Sure.
Right. Like different ways of figuring out what that balance is for particular families.
Mm-hmm.
But what I like about that approach is that the child has agency.
Yes.
They can choose how much time they want.
Yes.
They have a way of getting the time that they want.
Yes.
But you're making them do something that's good for them.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And either connects them to someone or really connects them. I mean, for this father, I just think about this guitar and that common interest that actually builds something that they can do together as a hobby into the rest of their lives, you know, together. Right. And so that's such a neat way to make that connection. But also, like you said, I don't know that a child might be able to overcome that dip or that resistance or that difficult part of really digging into something that can feel really difficult as we're getting better at a skill. Sometimes it does reach that point where you feel like you're up against a wall. And so you need some encouragement there. I want to be mindful of your time here, but before
all my stories.
And no, you know, I love the stories because it really anchors these ideas in a way that people can envision. I mean, there's so many different things that we can talk about. You've done extensive work and books around homelessness and poverty and all of these things that are so, so important. So of course, I'll be pointing people to your books and your online courses, and they can explore those topics with more detail, I think, because you're so knowledgeable. And I mean, you have such a treasure trove of resources. But before we jump into those rapid fire questions, I'd like to talk just a little bit about ADHD and how that can present, because I think this is a really important topic to speak about as it relates to education. Because quite often we can, you know, we might have children in our classroom that exhibit, you know, elements of ADHD, and sometimes, you know, if you could talk about sort of the three ways that it presents, but also how do we approach a child with ADHD, understanding that they are going to have a number of different negative sort of interactions throughout the course of their day. And I've thought about this so often in terms of how those negative interactions can compound over the course of one day, but then over the course of a child's educational experience. And then we sort of wonder, you know, why don't they care about school? Why don't they like school?
Absolutely.
Right? And it's like this
exactly
backpack of negative interactions. So I, you know, obviously I've been mindful of this, but there's that practical piece that says, well, we still need to provide some amount of feedback. So can you speak to sort of how ADHD can present within the classroom or even within our homes, and then how we can approach it and support a child who exhibits those signs and do so in a really respectful manner, knowing how hard it can be to receive that feedback?
Sure. So let's just talk about how it can manifest. I think one thing that's important for people to know is that every form of ADHD now is called ADHD.
Mm.
There used to be a time in the 90s when we used to say ADD and ADHD, and ADD was for that inattentive type and ADHD was for that hyperactive impulsive type.
Mm.
But now all forms of ADHD are referred to as ADHD, and clinicians specify the subtypes. The subtypes are predominantly inattentive presentation, which is that forgetful, daydreamy, inattentive, distractible mm-hmm. child who loses things, forgets their coat on the bus, doesn't remember to bring their lunch, mm-hmm. Forgets that there's a test, did their homework but left it on the kitchen table. Right? You know, that's yes. the predominantly inattentive type. The predominantly hyperactive impulsive type is the child that can't sit still, you know, can't sit through an assembly, can't sit at, like, constantly wanting to get out of their desk and walk around.
Right.
The impulsivity might make them blurt out in class. So they don't put their hand, they blurt out, but they also might blurt into, like, force themselves into the games of other children or mm. into conversations of other children. And then there's combined type, which is a child who meets criteria in both areas. So they're inattentive and distractible and also hyperactive impulsive. Mm. I would say that's, for me, at least in my practice, the most common type that I see. Mm. The one thing to understand about ADHD is that the symptoms that are presenting are actually quite normal or typical at an earlier stage of development. Mm. So like a three-year-old couldn't sit through an assembly, no. right? But unlike other disorders, like, for example, depression and not being able to get out of bed is not normal or typical at any stage of development.
Right.
So what can be difficult for parents and teachers is to understand actually that ADHD is a disorder. And even though you've seen that kind of symptom in lots and lots of other kids that are younger, it doesn't mean that this kid is just poorly behaved, right?
Yes.
I think the one thing to understand about ADHD is that children really, really can't help it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And sometimes parents will say to me, but they'll play video games for hours. But we know that people with ADHD can hyperfocus if they're really motivated or it's like highly entertaining and stimulating. They can.
Yes.
And also you can have children with ADHD who can pull it together for an exam because it's a high stakes moment and they've just been able to pull it together and hyper-focus and they've learned how to do that. The difference is that they can't do that every single day. They can't sustain that attention over a longer period of time. And when you're struggling with ADHD, it's like a whole nother layer.
Mm-hmm.
It's like wearing a backpack full of bricks every single day.
Yes.
And it's hard and it's a slug to get through your day. And sometimes you just don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're just non-compliant and you're just not wanting to do it, it's not that you're a bad kid. It's that you're overwhelmed and it's just been too much.
Mm.
So that's what it looks like. What can you do as a parent or as a teacher? Number one is you let the child know that it's not their fault.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know you forgot your homework. It's not your fault. I know you didn't put up your hand. It's not your fault. But how can we try to learn this skill? How can I help you learn this skill? How can we create little hints to remember your homework? You know, can you take a photo of the board with your phone? Can I put little reminder notes in your lunch kit? You know, what can I do to help you?
Mm-hmm.
How can we do that together? Because I know it's too much for you to do on your own. So it's what I think is the most important thing is for that child not to feel shamed, like we were talking about earlier,
mm-hmm.
and that there's a recognition that there's an element that goes beyond their control.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that I would do is you chunk stuff up into pieces. And I think that's incredibly important. So you have a book report due on the 30th of this month. How do we work our way backwards? You know, what's the first thing you need to do and by when? What's the second thing you need to do and by when? So you take that big task and you chunk it into little stages,
mm-hmm.
And you do one stage at a time. And you do the stages that you can by yourself, but we do the stages together where you need help. But we've modeled over and over again how to take a big task that seems difficult, and we break it into smaller chunks. Sometimes for a child, it might be giving instructions one instruction at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it might be if you're writing a longer exam that we have a little timer, and every 15 minutes I encourage you to get up and walk around and have a drink of water and then come back and have a seat again.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're doing is we're creating a way to manage. So we're like, it's like executive functions,
yes.
right? We're creating a way for it to manage, and we're doing it together completely in a place of absolute acceptance.
Yes.
And, you know, like there's no judgment on my part that you need me to help you break that into chunks.
Yes. Because I think that's where the shaming can come in. And that's where sort of the layering of negative sort of connotation that comes with our interactions can come into it, which is damaging. And I think it can be very difficult for a child to overcome that sort of that additional feeling, right? And it reinforces, okay, well, I guess I'm just a bad person or whatever it is, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
That's wonderful. Thank you for that. Is there anything, I mean, again, you have so many important topics that you speak to in your courses and in your books, but is there anything, you know, related to this conversation that you'd like to touch on or reinforce before we move on to the other questions?
Well, I would say the concept of forgiveness has been something that's been on my mind and my heart over this last month. And I would say that there's tremendous power in forgiveness. Mm-hmm. There's power in forgiving yourself. Mm-hmm. There's power in forgiving another person. There's grace in authentic forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And I guess I would ask the people listening to this podcast to consider how that concept of forgiveness can be empowered or brought to life in their own lives, their own practice.
I love that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've thought about forgiveness myself quite a bit. And I think sometimes there can be this confusing notion of forgiveness as condoning. And I think it was Oprah Winfrey that sort of brought this idea to the forefront of my mind, which really sat well with me, is this idea of forgiveness as you can stop wishing that the past was different and accept it as it was. And for me, I think that's been a definition of forgiveness that sort of resonates deeply with me, is sort of this ability to accept and stop wishing that, you know, if I was wronged in the past or something didn't go well, you know, perseverating on that and move, you know, being okay to kind of move on and accept it as it is and whatever actions may or may not come out of that. Would you sort of agree with that perspective?
Mm-hmm. I think forgiveness is something we all have the power to enact. Mm. And I think forgiving ourselves truly is as important to learn how to do as to forgive other people. Mm. And again, it's not like saying that what happened was okay.
Yes.
But it's accepting that sometimes mistakes happen, sometimes transgressions occur.
Yes.
And it doesn't mean that other person is going to keep on doing it over and over again. You're not condoning that.
Sure.
But the fact that it happened and the fact that the person was genuinely sorry and apologized, there's beauty in being gracious in that moment of accepting that apology.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think there's pain in not, you know, not accepting that apology. Yeah.
Yes.
And it lingers then, right?
Yeah.
And it's unhealthy at that point.
Mm-hmm. And can be corrosive for sure. That's wonderful. I think that's a really important point. Could you define what kindness means to you?
Gentle acceptance.
Hmm. What book or books have you gifted most often to people?
How full is your bucket?
Oh, it's a good one. Mm-hmm. What one skill or superpower does a teacher need to lead with in order to be effective?
Wisdom.
And what about for a principal? Is it the same or different?
Leadership.
Dr. Jillian Roberts, this has been such a pleasure, and you have so much wisdom when we talk about wisdom, so much wisdom about how we can treat one another, treat ourselves, and treat the children in our charge. And I just really appreciate you taking the time to join me on this podcast in this very, very important conversation.
Well, thank you so much for letting me share my thoughts with you and for your time as well.
This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating a kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gained from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag #SmallActBigImpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.